Chapter 6. After dinner I rolled a cigarette and stretched myself at ease upon the pile of furs before the doorway, with a Jor's head pillowed in my lap and a feeling of great content pervading me. It was the first time since my plane had topped the barrier cliffs of Kasbak that I had felt any sense of peace or security. My hand wandered to the velvet cheek of the girl I had claimed as mine, and to her luxuriant hair and the golden fillet which bound it close to her shapely head. Her slender fingers groping upward sought mine, and drew them to her lips, and then I gathered her in my arms, and crushed her to me, smothering her mouth with a long, long kiss. It was the first time that passion had tinged my intercourse with Ajor. We were alone, and the hut was ours until morning. But now from beyond the palisade in the direction of the main gate came the hallooing of men, and the answering calls and queries of the guard. We listened. Returning hunters, no doubt. We heard them enter the village amidst the barking dogs. I have forgotten to mention the dogs of Krolu. The village swarmed with them, gaunt wolf-like creatures that guarded the herd by day when it grazed without the palisade, 10 dogs to a cow. By night the cows were herded in an outer enclosure roofed against the onslaughts of the carnivorous cats, and the dogs, with the exception of a few, were brought into the village. These few well-tested brutes remained with the herd. During the day they fed plentifully upon the beasts of prey which they killed in protection of the herd, so that their keep amounted to nothing at all. Shortly after the commotion at the gate had subsided, Ajor and I arose to enter the hut, and at the same time a warrior appeared from one of the twisted alleys which, lying between the irregularly placed huts and groups of huts, form the streets of the Krolu village. The fellow halted before us and addressed me, saying that Altan desired my presence at his hut. The wording of the invitation and the manner of the messenger threw me entirely off my guard, so cordial was the one and respectful the other, and the result was that I went willingly, telling Ajor that I would return presently. I had laid my arms and ammunition aside, as soon as we had taken over the hut, and I left them with Ajor now, as I had noticed that aside from their hunting knives the men of Krolu bore no weapons about the village streets. There was an atmosphere of peace and security within that village that I had not hoped to experience within Kasbak, and after what I had passed through, it must have cast a numbing spell over my faculties of judgment and reason. I had eaten of the lotus flower of safety. Dangers no longer threatened, for they had ceased to be. The messenger led me through the labyrinthine alleys to an open plaza near the center of the village. At one end of this plaza was a long hut, much the largest that I had yet seen, before the door of which were many warriors. I could see that the interior was lighted, and that a great number of men were gathered within. The dogs about the plaza were as thick as fleas, and those I approached closely evinced a strong desire to devour me, their noses evidently apprising them of the fact that I was of an alien race, since they paid no attention whatever to my companion. Once inside the council hut, for such it appeared to be, I found a large concourse of warriors seated, or rather squatted, around the floor. At one end of the oval space which the warriors left down the center of the room stood Altan, and another warrior whom I immediately recognized as a Galu, and then I saw that there were many Galus present. About the walls were a number of flaming torches stuck in holes in a clay plaster which evidently served the purpose of preventing the inflammable wood and grasses of which the hut was composed from being ignited by the flames. Lying about among the warriors or wandering restlessly to and fro were a number of savage dogs. The warriors eyed me curiously as I entered, especially the Galus, and then I was conducted into the center of the group, and led forward toward Altan. As I advanced I felt one of the dogs sniffing at my heels, and of a sudden a great brute leaped upon my back. As I turned to thrust it aside before its fangs found a hold upon me, I beheld a huge Airedale leaping frantically about me. The grinning jaws, the half-closed eyes, the back-laid ears spoke to me louder than might the words of man, that here was no savage enemy, but a joyous friend, and then I recognized him, and fell to one knee and put my arms about his neck, while he whined and cried with joy. It was Knobs, dear old Knobs. Bowen Tyler's Knobs, who had loved me next to his master. Where is the master of this dog? I asked, turning toward Al Tan. The chieftain inclined his head toward the Galu standing at his side. He belongs to Dusin the Galu, he replied. He belongs to Bowen J. Tyler Jr., of Santa Monica, I retorted, and I want to know where his master is. The Galu shrugged. He dog is mine, he said. He came to me Corsva Joe, and he is unlike any dog in Casback, being kind and docile, and yet a killer when aroused. I would not part with him. I do not know the man of whom you speak. So this was Dusin. This was the man from whom Major had fled. I wondered if he knew that she was here. I wondered if they had sent for me because of her, but after they had commenced to question me, my mind was relieved. They did not mention Ajor. Their interest seemed centered upon the strange world from which I had come, my journey to Casback and my intentions now that I had arrived. I answered them frankly as I had nothing to conceal and assured them that my only wish was to find my friends and return to my own country. In the Galu Dusin and his warriors I saw something of the explanation of the term Olden Race which is applied to them, for their ornaments and weapons were either wholly of beaten gold, or heavily decorated with the precious metal. They were a very imposing set of men, tall and straight and handsome. About their heads were bands of gold like that which Ajor wore, and from their left shoulders depended the leopard tails of the Galus. In addition to the deerskin tunic which constituted the major portion of their apparel, each carried a light blanket of barbaric, yet beautiful design, the first evidence of weaving I had seen in Casback. Ajor had had no blanket, having lost it during her flight from the attentions of Dusin, nor was she so heavily encrusted with gold as these male members of her tribe. The audience must have lasted fully an hour when Al Tan signified that I might return to my hut. All the time Knobs had lain quietly at my feet, but the instant that I turned to leave, he was up and after me. Dusin called to him, but the terrier never, even so much as looked in his direction. I had almost reached the doorway leading from the council hall, when Al Tan rose and called after me. Top! He shouted. Top, stranger! The beast of Dusin the Galu follows you. The dog is not Dusin's, I replied. He belongs to my friend, as I told you, and he prefers to stay with me until his master is found. And I turned again to resume my way. I had taken but a few steps when I heard a commotion behind me, and at the same moment a man leaned close and whispered, Azar! Close to my ear, Kazer, the Caspakian equivalent of beware. It was Tamar. As he spoke, he turned quickly away, as though loath to have others see that he knew me, and at the same instant I wheeled to discover Dusin striding rapidly after me. Al Tan followed him, and it was evident that both were angry. Dusin, a weapon half-drawn, approached truculently. He beast is mine, he reiterated. Old you steal him? He is not yours nor mine, I replied, and I am not stealing him. If he wishes to follow you, he may, I will not interfere, but if he wishes to follow me, he shall, nor shall you prevent. I turned to Al Tan. Is not that fair? I demanded. Let the dog choose his master. Dusin, without waiting for Al Tan's reply, reached for Knobs, and grasped him by the scruff of the neck. I did not interfere, for I guessed what would happen, and it did. With a savage growl, Knobs turned like lightning upon the Galu, wrenched loose from his hold and leaped for his throat. The man stepped back and warded off the first attack with a heavy blow of his fist, immediately drawing his knife with which to meet the Airedale's return. And Knobs would have returned, all right, had not I spoken to him. In a low voice I called him to heel. For just an instant he hesitated, standing there trembling, and with bared fangs, glaring at his foe, but he was well trained, and had been out with me quite as much as he had with Bowen. In fact, I had had most to do with his early training. Then he walked slowly and very stiff-legged to his place behind me. do scene, red with rage, would have had it out with the two of us had not Altan drawn him to one side, and whispered in his ear, upon which, with a grunt, the Galu walked straight back to the opposite end of the hall, while Nobbs and I continued upon our way toward the hut and the Ajor. As we passed out into the village plaza, I saw Chal as we were so close to one another that I could have reached out and touched him, and our eyes met. But though I greeted him pleasantly and paused to speak to him, he brushed past me without a sign of recognition. I was puzzled at his behavior, and then I recalled that Tamar, though he had warned me, had appeared not to wish to seem friendly with me. I could not understand their attitude, and was trying to puzzle out some sort of explanation, when the matter was suddenly driven from my mind by the report of a firearm. Instantly I broke into a run, my brain in a whirl of forebodings, for the only firearms in the Krolu country were those I had left in the hut with Ajor. That she was in danger I could not but fear, as she was now something of an adept in the handling of both the pistol and rifle, a fact which largely eliminated the chance that the shot had come from an accidentally discharged firearm. When I left the hut, I had felt that she and I were safe among friends. No thought of danger was in my mind. But since my audience with Altan, the presence and bearing of Dusin, and the strange attitude of both Tamar and Chalaz had each contributed toward arousing my suspicions, and now I ran along the narrow, winding alleys of the Krolu village with my heart fairly in my mouth. I am endowed with an excellent sense of direction, which has been greatly perfected by the years I have spent in the mountains, and upon the plains and deserts of my native state, so that it was with little, or no difficulty, that I found my way back to the hut in which I had left Ajor. As I entered the doorway, I called her name aloud. There was no response. I drew a box of matches from my pocket, and struck a light, and as the flame flared up, a half dozen brawny warriors leaped upon me from as many directions. But even in the brief instant that the flare lasted, I saw that Ajor was not within the hut, and that my arms and ammunition had been removed. As the six men leaped upon me, an angry growl burst from behind them. I had forgotten Nobbs. Like a demon of Hades sprang among those Krolu fighting men, tearing, rending, ripping with his long tusks and his mighty jaws. They had me down in an instant, and it goes without saying that the six of them could have kept me there had it not been for Nobbs. But while I was struggling to throw them off, Nobbs was springing first upon one, and then upon another of them until they were so put to it to preserve their hides and their lives from him, that they could give me only a small part of their attention. One of them was assiduously attempting to strike me on the head with his stone hatchet, but I caught his arm, and at the same time turned over upon my belly, after which it took but an instant to get my feet under me and rise suddenly. As I did so, I kept a grip upon the man's arm, carrying it over one shoulder. Then I leaned suddenly forward, and hurled my antagonist over my head to a hasty fall at the opposite side of the hut. In the dim light of the interior I saw that Nobbs had already accounted for one of the others, one who lay very quiet upon the floor, while the four remaining upon their feet were striking at him with knives and hatchets. Running to one side of the man I had just put out of the fighting, I seized his hatchet and knife, and in another moment was in the thick of the argument. I was no match for these savage warriors with their own weapons, and would soon have gone down to ignominious defeat and death had it not been for Nobbs, who alone was a match for the four of them. I never saw any creature so quick upon its feet as was that great Airedale, nor such frightful ferocity as he manifested in his attacks. It was as much the latter as the former which contributed to the undoing of our enemies, who, accustomed though they were to the ferocity of terrible creatures, seemed awed by the sight of this strange beast from another world battling at the side of his equally strange master. Yet they were no cowards, and only by teamwork did Nobbs and I overcome them at last. We would rush for a man, simultaneously, and as Nobbs leaped for him upon one side, I would strike at his head with the stone hatchet from the other. As the last man went down, I heard the running of many feet approaching us from the direction of the plaza. To be captured now would mean death. Yet I could not attempt to leave the village without first ascertaining the whereabouts of Ajor and releasing her, if she were held a captive. That I could escape the village I was not at all sure, but of one thing I was positive, that it would do neither Ajor nor myself any service, to remain where I was and be captured. So with Nobs, bloody but happy, following at heel, I turned down the first alley, and slunk away in the direction of the northern end of the village. Friendless and alone, hunted through the dark labyrinths of this savage community, I seldom have felt more helpless than at that moment. Yet far transcending any fear which I may have felt for my own safety was my concern for that of Ajor. What fate had befallen her? Where was she, and in whose power? That I should live to learn the answers to these queries I doubted, but that I should face death gladly in the attempt of, that I was certain. And why? With all my concern for the welfare of my friends who had accompanied me to Caprona, and of my best friend of all, Bowen J. Tyler Jr., I never yet had experienced the almost paralyzing fear for the safety of any other creature which now threw me alternately into a fever of despair and into a cold sweat of apprehension as my mind dwelt upon the fate on one bit of half-savage femininity, of whose very existence even I had not dreamed a few short weeks before. What was this hold that he had upon me? Was I bewitched, that my mind refused to function sanely, and that judgment and reason were dethroned by some mad sentiment which I steadfastly refused to believe was love? I had never been in love. I was not in love now, the very thought was preposterous. How could I, Thomas Billings, the right-hand man of the late Bowen J. Tyler Sr., one of America's foremost captains of industry, and the greatest man in California, be in love with A.A. The word stuck in my throat. Yet by my own American standards Ajor could be nothing else. At home, for all her beauty, for all her delicately tinted skin, little Ajor by her apparel, by the habits and customs and manners of her people, by her life, would have been classed a squaw. Tom Billings in love with a squaw. I shuddered at the thought. And then there came to my mind, in a sudden, brilliant flash upon the screen of recollection, the picture of Ajor as I had last seen her, and I lived again the delicious moment in which we had clung to one another, lips smothering lips, as I left her to go to the council hall of Altan. And I could have kicked myself for the snob and the cad, that my thoughts had proven me, who had always prided myself, that I was neither the one nor the other. These things ran through my mind as Nobs and I made our way through the dark village, the voices and footsteps of those who sought us still in our ears. These and many other things, nor could I escape the incontrovertible fact, that the little figure round which my recollections, and my hopes entwined themselves was that of Ajor, beloved barbarian. My reveries were broken in upon by a hoarse whisper from the black interior of a hut past which we were making our way. My name was called in a low voice, and a man stepped out beside me as I halted with raised knife. It was Chalaz. Quick, he warned. Enter. It is my hut, and they will not search it. I hesitated, recalled his attitude of a few minutes before, and as though he had read my thoughts, he said quickly, could not speak to you in the plaza without danger of arousing suspicions which would prevent me aiding you later, for word had gone out that Altan had turned against you, and would destroy you. This was after Dusin the Galu arrived. I followed him into the hut, and with Nobs at our heels we passed through several chambers into a remote and windowless apartment, where a small lamp sputtered in its unequal battle with the inky darkness. A hole in the roof permitted the smoke from burning oil egress, yet the atmosphere was far from lucid. Here Chalaz motioned me to a seat upon a furry hide spread upon the earthen floor. I am your friend, he said. Who saved my life? And I am no ingrate as is the Badu Altan. I will serve you, and there are others here who will serve you against Altan and this renegade Galu, Dusin. But where is Ajor? I asked, for I cared little for my own safety, while she was in danger. Ajor is safe too, he answered. He learned the designs of Altan and Dusin. The latter, learning that Ajor was here, demanded her, and Altan promised that he should have her. But when the warriors went together, Tamar went with them. Ajor tried to defend herself. She killed one of the warriors, and then Tamar picked her up in his arms when the others had taken her weapons from her. He told the others to look after the wounded man, who was really already dead, and to seize you upon your return, and that he, Tamar, would bear Ajor to Al-Tan. But instead of bearing her to Al-Tan, he took her to his own hut, where she now is with Soal, Tamar's she. It all happened very quickly. Tamar and I were in the council hut when Dusin attempted to take the dog from you. I was seeking Tamar for this work. He ran out immediately and accompanied the warriors to your hut, while I remained to watch what went on within the council hut, and to aid you, if you needed aid. What has happened since you know? I thanked him for his loyalty, and then asked him to take me to Ajor. But he said that it could not be done, as the village streets were filled with searchers. In fact, we could hear them passing to and fro among the huts, making inquiries, and at last Shalaz thought it best to go to the doorway of his dwelling, which consisted of many huts joined together, lest they enter and search. Shalaz was absent for a long time, several hours which seemed an eternity to me. All sounds of pursuit had long since ceased, and I was becoming uneasy because of his protracted absence, when I heard him returning through the other apartments of his dwelling. He was perturbed when he entered that in which I awaited him, and I saw a worried expression upon his face. "What is wrong?" I asked. "Have they found Ajor?" "No," he replied. "But Ajor is gone. She learned that you had escaped them, and was told that you had left the village, believing that she had escaped too. So all could not detain her. She made her way out over the top of the palisade, armed with only her knife." "Then I must go," I said, rising. Nobs rose and shook himself. He had been dead asleep when I spoke. "Yes," agreed Shalaz, "you must go at once. It is almost dawn. Dusin leaves at daylight to search for her." He leaned close to my ear and whispered, "Here are many to follow and help you. Al-Tan has agreed to aid Dusin against the Gaelus of Jor, but there are many of us who have combined to rise against Al-Tan and prevent this ruthless desecration of the laws and customs of the Krolu and of Kaspak. We will rise as Luada has ordained that we shall rise, and only thus. No Badu may win to the estate of a Galu by treachery and force of arms, while Shalaz lives, and may wield a heavy blow, and a sharp spear with true Krolus at his back. I hope that I may live to aid you," I replied. "If I had my weapons and my ammunition, I could do much. Do you know where they are?" "No," he said, "they have disappeared." "And then?" "8. You cannot go forth half-armed, and garbed as you are. You are going into the Galu country, and you must go as a Galu. Come." And without waiting for a reply, he led me into another apartment, or to be more explicit, another of the several huts which formed his cellular dwelling. Here was a pile of skins, weapons, and ornaments. "Em of your strange apparel," said Shalaz, "and I will fit you out as a true Galu. I have slain several of them in the raids of my early days as a Krolu, and here are their trappings." I saw the wisdom of his suggestion, and as my clothes were by now so ragged as to but half conceal my nakedness, I had no regrets in laying them aside. Stripped to the skin, I donned the red deerskin tunic, the leopard tail, the golden fillet, armlets, and leg ornaments of a Galu, with the belt, scabbard and knife, the shield, spear, bow, and arrow and the long rope which I learned now for the first time is the distinctive weapon of the Galu warrior. It is a rawhide rope, not dissimilar to those of the western plains and cow camps of my youth. The honda is a golden oval and accurate weight for the throwing of the noose. This heavy honda, Shalaz explained, is used as a weapon, being thrown with great force and accuracy at an enemy, and then coiled in for another cast. In hunting and in battle, they use both the noose and the honda. If several warriors surround a single foeman or quarry, they rope it with the noose from several sides. But a single warrior against a lone antagonist will attempt to brain his foe with the metal oval. I could not have been more pleased with any weapon, short of a rifle, which he could have found for me, since I have been adept with the rope from early childhood. but I must confess that I was less favorably inclined toward my apparel. Insofar as the sensation was concerned, I might as well have been entirely naked, so short and light was the tunic. When I asked Chalaz for the Kaspakian name for rope, he told me ga, and for the first time I understood the derivation of the word galu, which means ropeman. Entirely outfitted, I would not have known myself, so strange was my garb and my armament. Upon my back were slung my bow, arrows, shield, and short spear. From the center of my girdle depended my knife. At my right hip was my stone hatchet, and at my left hung the coils of my long rope. By reaching my right hand over my left shoulder, I could seize the spear arrows. My left hand could find my bow over my right shoulder, while a veritable contortionist act was necessary to place my shield in front of me and upon my left arm. The shield, long and oval, is utilized more as back armor than as a defense against frontal attack, for the close-set armlets of gold upon the left forearm are principally dependent upon to ward off knife, spear, hatchet, or arrow from in front. But against the greater carnivora and the attacks of several human antagonists, the shield is utilized to its best advantage, and carried by loops upon the left arm. Fully equipped, except for a blanket, I followed Chalaz from his domicile into the dark and deserted alleys of Krolu. Silently we crept along, Nob silent at heel, toward the nearest portion of the palisade. Here Chalaz bade me farewell, telling me that he hoped to see me soon among the Galus, as he felt that he called soon would come to him. I thanked him for his loyal assistance and promised that, whether I reached the Galu country or not, I should always stand ready to repay his kindness to me, and that he could count on me in the revolution against Altan. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.